Side 9, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 305.
His mother told him that in the old days you could catch a GS and WM passenger train at what was then Niebolt Street Station, but the passenger trains had stopped running around the time the Korean War was starting up. If you got on the northbound train, you went to Brownsville Station, she said, and from Brownsville you could catch a train that would take you all the way across Canada if you wanted, all the way to the Pacific. The southbound train would take you to Portland and then on down to Boston, and from South Station the country was yours.
But the passenger trains have gone the way of the trolley lines now, I guess. No one wants to ride a train when they can just jump in a Ford and go. You may never even ride one. But great long freights still came through Derry. They headed south, loaded down with pulpwood, paper, and potatoes, and north with manufactured goods for those towns of what Maine people sometimes called the Big Northern: Bangor, Millinocket, Machias, Presque Isle, Holton. Eddie particularly liked to watch the northbound car carriers with their loads of gleaming Fords and Chevys. I'll have me a car like one of those someday, he promised himself. Like one of those or even better. Maybe even a Cadillac. There were six tracks in all, swooping into the station like strands of cobweb tending toward the center. Bangor and Great Northern lines from the north, the Great Southern and Western Maine from the west, the Boston and Maine from the south, and Southern Seacoast from the east. One day, 2 years before, when Eddie had been standing near the latter line and watching a train go through, a drunken train man had thrown a crate out of a slow-moving boxcar at him. Eddie ducked and flinched backward, although the crate landed in the cinders 10 feet away. There were things inside it, live things that clicked and moved. "Last run, boy," the drunken train man had shouted. He pulled a flat brown bottle from one of the pockets of his denim jacket, tipped it up, drank, then flipped it into the cinders where it smashed. The train man pointed at the crate. "Take him home to your mum. Compliments of the Southern fucking Seacoast Bound for Welfare line." He had reeled forward to shout these last words as the train pulled away, gathering speed now, and for one alarming moment Eddie thought he was going to tumble right out. When the train was gone, Eddie went to the box and bent cautiously over it. He was afraid to get too close. The things inside were slithery and crawly. If the train man had yelled that they were for him, Eddie would have left them right there. But he had said, "Take him home to your mom." And, like Ben, when someone said mom, Eddie jumped. He scrounged a hank of rope from one of the empty Quonset warehouses and tied the crate onto the package carrier of his bike. His mother had peered inside the crate even more warily than Eddie himself, and then she screamed, but with delight rather than terror. There were four lobsters in the crate, big two-pounders with their claws pegged. She cooked them for supper and had been extremely grumpy with Eddie when he wouldn't eat any. "What do you think the Rockefellers are eating this evening at their place in Bar Harbor?" she asked indignantly. "What do you think the swells are eating at 21 and Sardi's in New York City? Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches?" "They're eating lobster, Eddie, same as we are. Now come on, give it a try." But Eddie wouldn't. At least that was what his mother said. Maybe it was true, but inside it felt more to Eddie like couldn't than wouldn't. He kept thinking of the way they had slithered inside the crate and the clicking sounds their claws had made. She kept telling him how delicious they were and what a treat he was missing until he started to gasp for breath and had to use his aspirator. Then she left him alone. Eddie retreated to his bedroom and read. His mother called up her friend Eleanor Dunton. Eleanor came over and the two of them read old copies of Photoplay and Screen Secrets and giggled over the gossip columns and gorged themselves on cold lobster salad. When Eddie got up for school the next morning, his mother was still in bed, snoring away and letting frequent farts that sounded like long, mellow cornet notes. She was getting off some good ones, Richie would have said. There was nothing left in the bowl where the lobster salad had been except a few tiny blots of mayonnaise. That was the last Southern Seacoast train Eddie ever saw. And when he later saw Mr. Braddock, the Derry trainmaster, he asked him hesitantly what had happened.
"Company went broke," Mr. Braddock said. "That's all there was to it. Don't you read the papers? It's happening all over the damn country. Now get out of here. This ain't no place for a kid."
After that, Eddie would sometimes walk along Track 4, which had been the Southern Seacoast track, and listen as a mental conductor chanted names inside his head, reading them off in a lovely down-east monotone. Those names, those magic names.
Camden, Rockland, Bar Harbor, pronounced Bahaba, Wiscasset, Bath, Portland, Ogunquit, the Berwicks. He would walk down track 4 heading east until he got tired, and the weeds growing up between the cross ties made him feel sad. Once he had looked up and seen seagulls, probably just fat old dump gulls who didn't give a shit if they ever saw the ocean, but that had not occurred to him then. Wheeling and crying overhead, and the sound of their voices had made him cry a little too. There had once been a gate at the entrance to the train yards, but it had blown over in a windstorm and no one had bothered to replace it. Eddie came and went pretty much as he liked, although Mr. Braddock would kick him out if he saw him, or any other kid for that matter. There were truck drivers who would chase you sometimes, but not very far, because they thought you were hanging around just so you could hawk something, and sometimes kids did. Mostly, though, the place was quiet. There was a guard booth, but it was empty, its glass windows broken by stones. There had been no full-time security service since 1950 or so. Mr. Braddock shooed the kids away by day, and a night watchman drove through 4 or 5 times a night in an old Studebaker with a searchlight mounted outside the vent window, and that was all. There were tramps and hobos sometimes, though. If anything about the train yard scared Eddie, they did. Men with unshaven cheeks and cracked skin and blisters on their hands and cold sores on their lips. They rode the rails for a while and then climbed down for a while and spent some time in Derry and then got on another train and went somewhere else. Sometimes they had missing fingers. Usually they were drunk and wanted to know if you had a cigarette. One of these fellows had crawled out from under the porch of the house at 29 Niebold Street one day and had offered to give Eddie a blowjob for a quarter. Eddie had backed away. His skin like ice, his mouth as dry as lint balls. One of the hobo's nostrils had been eaten away. You could look right into the red scabby channel. "I don't have a quarter," Eddie said, backing toward his bike.
"I'll do it for a dime,"
the hobo croaked, coming toward him. He was wearing old green flannel pants. Yellow puke was stiffening across the lap. He unzipped his fly and reached inside. He was trying to grin. His nose was a red horror. I don't have a dime either, Eddie said, and suddenly thought, oh my God, he's got leprosy. If he touches me, I'll catch it too. His control snapped and he ran. He heard the hobo break into a shuffling run behind him, his old string-tied shoes slapping and flapping across the riotous lawn of the empty salt box house.
Come back here, kid. I'll blow you for free. Come back here.
Eddie had leaped on his bike, wheezing now, feeling his throat closing up to a pinhole. His chest had taken on weight. He hit the pedals and was just picking up speed when one of the hobo's hands struck the package carrier. The bike shimmied. Eddie looked over his shoulder and saw the hobo running along behind the rear wheel, gaining. His lips drawn back from the black stumps of his teeth in an expression which might have been either desperation or fury. In spite of the stones lying on his chest, Eddie had pedaled even faster. Expecting that one of the hobo's scab-crusted hands would close over his arm at any moment, pulling him from his Raleigh and dumping him in the ditch where God knew what would happen to him. He hadn't dared look around until he had flashed past the church school and through the Route 2 intersection. The bow was gone. Eddie held this terrible story inside him for almost a week and then confided it to Richie Tozier and Bill Denbro one day when they were reading comics over the garage.
He didn't have leprosy, you dummy, Richie said. He had the Sith.
Eddie looked at Bill to see if Richie was ribbing him. He had never heard of a disease called the Sift before. It sounded like something Richie might have made up.
Is there such a thing as the Sift, Bill?
Bill nodded gravely.
Only it's the Sith, not the Sift.
It's short for syphilis.
What's that?
It's a disease you get from fucking, Richie said. You know about fucking, don't you, Eds?
Sure,
Eddie said. He hoped he wasn't blushing. He knew that when you got older, stuff came out of your penis when it was hard. Vincent Booger's Taliendo had filled him in on the rest one day at school.
What you did when you fucked, according to Booger's, was you rubbed your cock against a girl's stomach until it got hard. Your cock, not the girl's stomach. Then you rubbed some more until you started to get the feeling.
When Eddie asked what that meant, Boogers had only shaken his head in a mysterious way. Boogers said that you couldn't describe it, but you'd know it as soon as you got it. He said you could practice by lying in the bathtub and rubbing your cock with ivory soap. Eddie had tried this, but the only feeling he got was the need to urinate after a while. Anyway, Boogers went on, after you got the feeling, this stuff came out of your penis.
Most kids called it cum, Boogers said, but his big brother had told him that the really scientific word for it was jism. And when you got the feeling, you had to grab your cock and aim it real fast so you could shoot the jism into the girl's belly button as soon as it came out. It went down into her stomach and made a baby there.
Do girls like that?
Eddie had asked Boogers Taliendo. He himself was sort of appalled.
I guess they must, Boogers had replied, looking mystified himself.
Now listen up, Eds, Richie said, because there may be questions later. Some women have got this disease, some men too, but mostly it's women. A guy can get it from a woman.
Or another guy if they're queer, Bill added.
Right. The important thing is you get the SIF from screwing someone who's already got it.
What does it do? Eddie asked.
Makes you rot, Richie said simply. Eddie stared at him, horrified. It's bad, I know, but it's true, Richie said. Your nose is the first thing to go. Some guys with the SIF, their noses fall right off. Then they're cocks.
Papa, please, Bill said. I just ate.
Hey, man, this is science, Richie said.
So what's the difference between leprosy and the SIF?
Eddie asked. You don't get leprosy from fucking, Richie said promptly, and then went off into a gale of laughter that left both Bill and Eddie mystified.
7.
Following that day, the house at 29 Niebolt Street had taken on a kind of glow in Eddie's imagination. Looking at its weedy yard and its slumped porch and the boards nailed across its windows, he would feel an unhealthy fascination take hold of him. And 6 weeks ago, he had parked his bike on the gravelly verge of the street, the sidewalk ended 4 houses farther back, and walked across the lawn toward the porch of that house. His heart had been beating hard in his chest, and his mouth had that dry taste again. Listening to Bill's story of the dreadful picture, he knew that what he had felt when approaching that house was about the same as what Bill had felt going into George's room. He did not feel as if he was in control of himself. He felt pushed. It did not seem as if his feet were moving. Instead, the house itself, brooding and silent, seemed to draw closer to where he stood. Faintly, he could hear a diesel engine in the train yard. That and the liquid metallic slam of couplings being made. They were shunting some cars onto sidings, picking up others, making a train. His hand gripped his aspirator, but oddly, his asthma had not closed down as it had on the day he fled from the hobo with the rotted nose. There was only that sense of standing still and watching the house slide stealthily toward him as if on a hidden track. Eddie looked under the porch. There was no one there. It was not really surprising. This was spring, and the hobo showed up most frequently in Derry from late September to early November. During those 6 weeks or so, a man could pick up day work on one of the outlying farms if he looked even half decent. There were potatoes and apples to pick, snow fence to string, barn and shed roofs which needed to be patched before December came along, whistling up winter. No hobos under the porch, but plenty of sign that they had been there. Empty beer cans, empty beer bottles, empty liquor bottles. A dirt-crusted blanket lay against the brick foundation like a dead dog. There were drifts of crumpled newspapers and one old shoe and a smell like garbage. There were thick layers of old leaves under there. Not wanting to do it, but unable to help himself, Eddie had crawled under the porch. He could feel his heartbeat slamming in his head now, driving white spots of light across his field of vision. The smell was worse underneath, booze and sweat and the dark brown perfume of decaying leaves. The old leaves didn't even crackle under his hands and knees. They and the old newspapers only sighed.
I'm a hobo, Eddie thought incoherently. I'm a hobo, and I ride the rods. That's what I do. Ain't got no money, ain't got no home, but I got me a bottle and a dollar and a place to sleep. I'll pick apples this week and potatoes the week after that, and when the frost locks up the ground like money inside a bank vault, why, I'll hop a GS and WM box that smells of sugar beets, and I'll sit in the corner and pull some hay over me if there is some, and I'll drink me a little drink and chew me a little chew, and sooner or later I'll get to Portland or Beantown, and if I don't get busted by a railroad security dick, I'll hop one of those Bama Star boxes and head down south, and when I get there, I'll pick lemons or limes or oranges. And if I get vagged, I'll build roads for tourists to ride on. Hell, I done it before, ain't I? I'm just a lonesome old hobo. Ain't got no money, ain't got no home, but I got me one thing. I got me a disease that's eating me up. My skin's cracking open, my teeth are falling out, and you know what? I can feel myself turning bad like an apple that's going soft. I can feel it happening, eating from the inside to the out, eating, eating, eating me.
Eddie pulled the stiffening blanket aside, tweezing at it with his thumb and forefinger, grimacing at its matted feel. One of those low cellar windows was directly behind it, one pane broken, the other opaque with dirt. He leaned forward, now feeling almost hypnotized. He leaned closer to the window, closer to the cellar darkness, breathing in that smell of age and must and dry rot, closer and closer to the black. And surely the leper would have caught him if his asthma hadn't picked that exact moment to kick up. It cramped his lungs with a weight that was painless yet frightening. His breath at once took on the familiar hateful whistling sound. He drew back, and that was when the face appeared. Its coming was so sudden, so startling, and yet at the same time so expected, that Eddie could not have screamed even if he hadn't been having an asthma attack. His eyes bulged, his mouth creaked open. It was not the hobo with the flayed nose, but there were resemblances, terrible resemblances. And yet, this thing could not be human. Nothing could be so eaten up and remain alive. The skin of its forehead was split open. White bone, coated with a membrane of yellow mucousy stuff, peered through like the lens of a bleary searchlight. The nose was a bridge of raw gristle above two red flaring channels. One eye was a gleeful blue, the other socket was filled with a mass of spongy brown-black tissue. The leper's lower lip sagged like liver. It had no upper lip at all. Its teeth poked out in a sneering ring. It shot one hand out through the broken pane. It shot the other through the dirty glass to the left, shattering it to fragments. Its questing, clutching hands crawled with sores. Beetles crawled and lumbered busily to and fro. Mewling, gasping, Eddie hunched his way backward. He could hardly breathe. His heart was a runaway engine in his chest. The leper appeared to be wearing the ragged remains of some strange silvery suit. Things were crawling in the straggles of its brown hair.
How about a blowjob, Eddie?
The apparition croaked, grinning with its remains of a mouth. It lilted.
Bobby does it for a dime. He will do it any time. 15 cents for overtime.
It winked.
That's me, Eddie. Bob Gray. And now that we've been properly introduced...
One of its hands splattered against Eddie's right shoulder. Eddie screamed thinly.
That's all right,
the leper said, and Eddie saw with dreamlike terror that it was crawling out of the window. The bony shield behind its peeling forehead snapped the thin wooden strip between the two panes. Its hands clawed through the leafy, mulchy earth. The silver shoulders of its suit, costume, whatever it was, began to push through the gap. That one glaring blue eye never left Eddie's face.
Here I come, Eddie. That's all right,
it croaked.
You'll like it down here with us. Some of your friends are down here.
Its hand reached out again, and in some corner of his panic-maddened, screaming mind, Eddie was suddenly, coldly sure that if that thing touched his bare skin, he would begin to rot, too. The thought broke his paralysis. He skittered backward on his hands and knees, then turned and lunged for the far end of the porch. Sunlight, falling in narrow dusty beams through the cracks between the porch boards, striped his face from moment to moment. His head pushed through the dusty cobwebs that settled in his hair. He looked back over his shoulder and saw that the leper was halfway out.
It won't do you any good to run, Eddie,
it called. Eddie had reached the far end of the porch. There was a latticework skirt here. The sun shone through it, printing diamonds of light on his cheeks and forehead. He lowered his head and slammed into it with no hesitation at all, tearing the entire skirt free with a scream of rusted halfpenny nails. There was a tangle of rose bushes beyond, and Eddie tore through these, stumbling to his feet as he did so, not feeling the thorns that scrawled shallow cuts along his arms and cheeks and neck. He turned and backed away on buckling legs, pulling his aspirator out of his pocket, triggering it. Surely it hadn't really happened. He had been thinking about that hobo, and his mind had, well, had just put on a show. Shown him a movie, a horror movie, like one of those Saturday matinee pictures with Frankenstein and Wolfman that they had sometimes at the Bijou or the Gem or the Aladdin. Sure, that was all. He had scared himself. What an asshole. There was even time to utter a shaky laugh at the unsuspected vividness of his imagination before the rotting hand shot out from under the porch, clawing at the rose bushes with mindless ferocity, pulling at them, stripping them, printing beads of blood on them.
Eddie shrieked. The leper was crawling out. It was wearing a clown suit, he saw. A clown suit with big orange buttons down the front. It saw Eddie and grinned. Its half-mouth dropped open and its tongue lolled out. Eddie shrieked again, but no one could have heard one boy's breathless shriek under the pounding of the diesel engine in the train yard. The leper's tongue had not just dropped from its mouth. It was at least 3 feet long and had unrolled like a party favor. It came to an arrow point which dragged in the dirt. Foam, thick, sticky, and yellowish, coursed along it. Bugs crawled over it. The rose bushes, which had been showing the first touches of spring green when Eddie broke through them, now turned a dead and lacy black.
Blowjob,
the leper whispered and tottered to its feet. Eddie raced for his bike. It was the same race as before, only it now had the quality of a nightmare, where you can only move with the most agonizing slowness no matter how hard you try to go fast. And in those dreams, didn't you always hear or feel something, some it, gaining on you? Didn't you always smell its stinking breath, as Eddie was smelling it now? For a moment he felt a wild hope. Perhaps this really was a nightmare. Perhaps he would awake in his own bed, bathed in sweat, shaking, maybe even crying, but alive, safe. Then he pushed the thought away. Its charm was deadly, its comfort fatal. He did not try to mount his bike immediately. He ran with it instead, head down, pushing the handlebars. He felt as if he was drowning, not in water, but inside his own chest.
Blowjob,
the leper whispered again.
Come back any time, Eddie. Bring your friends.
Its rotting fingers seemed to touch the back of his neck, but perhaps that was only a dangling strand of cobweb from under the porch, caught in his hair and brushing away his shrinking flesh. Eddie leaped onto his bike and pedaled away, not caring that his throat had closed up tight as Tilly again, not giving two sucks for his asthma, not looking back. He didn't look back until he was almost home. And, of course, there was nothing behind him when he finally did, but two kids headed over to the park to play ball. That night, lying straight as a poker in bed, one hand folded tightly around his aspirator, looking into the shadows, he heard the leper whisper,
"It won't do you any good to run, Eddie."
8. "Wow," Richie said respectfully. It was the first thing any of them had said since Bill Dendro finished his story.
"Have you got another cigarette, River Richie?"
Richie gave him the last one in the pack he had hawked almost empty from his dad's desk drawer. He even lit it for Bill.
"You didn't dream it, Bill?"
Stan asked suddenly. Bill shook his head.
No, the dream."
"Real," Eddie said in a low voice. Bill looked at him sharply.
What? "Real," I said.
Eddie looked at him almost resentfully.
"It really happened. It was real."
And before he could stop himself, before he even knew he was going to do it, Eddie found himself telling the story of the leper that had come crawling out of the basement at 29 Niebolt Street. Halfway through the telling, he began to gasp and had to use his aspirator. At the end, he burst into shrill tears, his thin body shaking. They all looked at him uncomfortably, and then Stan put a hand on his back. Bill gave him an awkward hug while the others glanced away, embarrassed.
"That's all right, Eddie. It's okay.
"I saw it, too,"
Ben Hanscom said suddenly. His voice was flat and harsh and scared. Eddie looked up, his face still naked with tears, his eyes red and raw-looking.
"What?"
"I saw the clown," Ben said. "Only he wasn't like you said, at least not when I saw him. He wasn't all gushy. He was dry."
He paused, ducked his head, and looked at his hands, which lay palely on his elephantine thighs.
"I think he was the mummy."
"Like in the movies?" Eddie asked.
"Like that, but not like that," Ben said slowly.
"In the movies, he looks fake. It's scary, but you can tell it's a put-up job, you know? All those bandages, they look too neat or something. But this guy, he looked the way a real mummy would look, I think. If you actually found one in a room under a pyramid, I mean. Except for the suit.
Wa-wa-wa-hut-sahut.
Ben looked at Eddie.
"A silver suit with big orange buttons down the front."
Eddie's mouth dropped open. He shut it and said,
"If you're kidding, say so. I still dream about that guy under the porch."
"It's not a joke," Ben said, and began to tell the story. He told it slowly, beginning with his volunteering to help Mrs. Douglas count and store books and ending with his own bad dreams. He spoke slowly, not looking at the others. He spoke as if deeply ashamed of his own behavior. He didn't raise his head again until the story was over.
"You must have dreamed it," Richie said finally.
He saw Ben wince and hurried on.
"Now don't take it personal, Big Ben, but you got to see that balloons can't, like, float against the wind."
"Pictures can't wink either," Ben said. Richie looked from Ben to Bill, troubled. Accusing Ben of dreaming awake was one thing, accusing Bill was something else. Bill was their leader, the guy they all looked up to. No one said so out loud, no one needed to. But Bill was the idea man, the guy who could think of something to do on a boring day, the guy who remembered games the others had forgotten. And in some odd way, they all sensed something comfortingly adult about Bill. Perhaps it was a sense of accountability, a feeling that Bill would take the responsibility if responsibility needed to be taken. The truth was, Richie believed Bill's story, crazy as it was. And perhaps he didn't want to believe Ben's, or Eddie's for that matter.
"Nothing like that ever happened to you, huh?" Eddie asked Richie.
Richie paused, began to say something, shook his head, paused again, then said,
"Scariest thing I've seen lately was Mark Prenderlist taking a leak in McCarran Park. Ugliest hogger you ever saw."
Ben said, "What about you, Stan?"
"No," Stan said quickly and looked somewhere else. His small face was pale, his lips pressed together so tightly they were white.
"What was there, something, Sister Stan?" Bill asked.
"No, I told you."
Stan got to his feet and walked to the embankment, hands in his pockets. He stood watching the water course over the top of the original dam and pile up behind the second water gate.
"Come on now, Stanley,"
Richie said in a shrill falsetto. This was another of his voices. Granny grunt. When speaking in his granny grunt voice, Richie would hobble around with one fist against the small of his back and cackle a lot. He still, however, sounded more like Richie Tozier than anyone else.
"Fess up, Stanley. Tell your old granny about the bad clown, and I'll give you a chocker chip cookie. You just tell..."
"Shut up,"
Stan yelled suddenly, whirling on Richie, who fell back a step or two, astonished.
"Just shut up."
"Yowza, boss,"
Richie said and sat down. He looked at Stan Uris mistrustfully. Bright spots of color flamed in Stan's cheeks, but he still looked more scared than mad.
"That's okay," Eddie said quietly. "Never mind, Stan."
"It wasn't a clown," Stanley said. His eyes flicked from one of them to the next, to the next, to the next. He seemed to struggle with himself.
You can tell," Bill said, also speaking quietly. "Well, we did it did."
"It wasn't a clown. It was..."
Which was when the carrying whiskey-roughened tones of Mr. Nell interrupted, making them all jump as if they had been shot.
"Jesus Christ on a jumped-up chariot-driven crutch. Look at this mess. Jesus Christ."
Chapter 8. Georgie's Room and the House on Niebold Street. 1. Richie Tozier turns off the radio, which has been blaring out Madonna's Like a Virgin on WZON, a station which declares itself to be Bangor's AM stereo rocker with a kind of hysterical frequency, pulls over to the side of the road, shuts down the engine of the Mustang the Avis people rented him at Bangor International, and gets out. He hears the pull and release of his own breath in his ears. He has seen a sign which has caused the flesh of his back to break out in hard ridges of goose flesh. He walks to the front of the car and puts one hand on its hood. He hears the engine ticking softly to itself as it cools. He hears a jay scream briefly and then shut up. There are crickets. And as far as the soundtrack goes, that's it. He has seen the sign. He passes it, and suddenly he is in Derry again. After 25 years, Richie Trashmouth Tozier has come home. He has... Burning agony suddenly needles into his eyes, breaking his thought cleanly off. He utters a strangled little shout, and his hands fly up to his face. The only time he felt anything even remotely like this burning pain was when he got an eyelash caught under one of his contacts in college. And that was only in one eye. This terrible pain is in both. Before he can reach even halfway to his face, the pain is gone. He lowers his hands again, slowly, thoughtfully, and looks down Route 7.
He left the turnpike at the Etna Haven exit, wanting, for some reason he doesn't understand, not to come in by the turnpike, which was still under construction in the dairy area when he and his folks shook the dust of this weird little town from their heels and headed out for the Midwest. No, the turnpike would have been quicker, but it would have been wrong. So he had driven along Route 9 through the sleeping nestle of buildings that was Haven Village, then turned off on Route 7, and as he went, the day grew steadily brighter. Now this sign. It was the same sort of sign which marked the borders of more than 600 Maine towns, but how this one had squeezed his heart. Penobscot County, Derry, Maine. Beyond that, an elk sign, a Rotary Club sign, and completing the Trinity, a sign proclaiming the fact that Derry Lions roar for the United Fund. Past that one is just Route 7 again, continuing on in a straight line between bulking banks of pine and spruce. In this silent light, as the day steadies itself, those trees look as dreamy as blue-gray cigarette smoke stacked on the moveless air of a sealed room. Derry, he thinks. Derry, God help me, Derry. Stone the crows. Here he is on Route 7, 5 miles up, if time or tornado has not carried it away in the intervening years, will be the Rulin Farms, where his mother bought all of their eggs and most of their vegetables. 2 miles beyond that, Route 7 became Witcham Road, and of course Witcham Road eventually became Witcham Street. Can you give me Hallelujah World without end, amen? And somewhere along there, between the Rulin Farms and town, he would drive past the Bowers place, and then the Hanlon place. A mile or so after Hanlon's, he would see the first glitter of the Kanduskeag and the first spreading tangle of poison green. The lush lowlands that had been known for some reason as the Barrens. I really don't know if I can face all of that, Richie thinks. I mean, let's tell the truth here, folks. I just don't know if I can. The whole previous night has passed in a dream for him. As long as he continued traveling, moving forward, making miles, the dream went on. But now he has stopped, or rather the sign has stopped him, and he has awakened to a strange truth. The dream was the reality. Derry is the reality. It seems he just cannot stop remembering. He thinks the memories will eventually drive him mad, and now he bites down on his lip and puts his hands together, palm to palm, tight, as if to keep himself from flying apart. He feels that he will fly apart, and soon. There seems to be some mad part of him which actually looks forward to what may be coming. But most of him only wonders how he's going to get through the next few days. And now his thoughts break off again. A deer is walking out into the road. He can hear the light thud of its spring soft hoofs on the tar. Richie's breath stops in mid-exhale, then slowly starts again. He looks dumbfounded, part of him thinking that he never saw anything like this on Rodeo Drive. No, he'd needed to come back home to see something like this. It's a doe. Doe, a deer, a female deer, a voice chants merrily in his head. She's come out of the woods on the right and pauses in the middle of Route 7, front legs on one side of the broken white line, rear legs on the other. Her dark eyes regard Rich Tozier mildly. He reads interest in those eyes, but no fear. He looks at her in wonder, thinking she's an omen or a portent or some sort of Madame Azanka shit like that. And then, quite unexpectedly, a memory of Mr. Nell comes to him. What a start he had given them that day, busting in on them in the wake of Bill's story and Ben's story and Eddie's story. The whole bunch of them had damn near gone up to heaven. Now looking at the deer, Rich draws in a deep breath and finds himself speaking in one of his voices. But for the first time in 25 years or more, it is the voice of the Irish cop, one he had incorporated into his repertoire after that memorable day. It comes rolling out of the morning silence like a great big bowling ball. It is louder and bigger than Richie would ever have believed.
Jesus Christ on a jumped-up chariot-driven crutch! What's a nice girl like you doing out in this wilderness, dear? Jesus Christ! You'll be getting on home before I decide to tell Father O'Staggers on ye.
Before the echoes have died away, before the first shocked jay can begin scolding him for his sacrilege, the doe flicks her tail at him like a truce flag and disappears into the smoky-looking firs on the left side of the road, leaving only a small pile of steaming pellets behind to show that, even at 37, Richie Tozier is still capable of getting off a good one from time to time. Richie begins to laugh. He is only chuckling at first, and then his own ludicrousness strikes him. Standing here in the dawn light of a Maine morning, 3,400 miles from home, shouting at a deer in the accents of an Irish cop. The chuckles become a string of giggles, the giggles become guffaws, the guffaws become howls, and he is finally reduced to holding on to his car while tears roll down his face, and he wonders dimly if he's going to wet his pants or what. Every time he starts to get control of himself, his eyes fix on that little clump of pellets and he goes off into fresh gales. Snorting and snickering, he is at last able to get back into the driver's seat and restart the Mustang's engine. An Orinco chemical fertilizer truck snores by in a blast of wind. After it passes him, Rich pulls out and heads for Derry again. He feels better now, in control. Or maybe it's just that he's moving again, making miles, and the dream has reasserted itself. He starts thinking about Mr. Nell again. Mr. Nell and that day by the dam. Mr. Nell had asked them who thought this little trick up. He can see the five of them looking uneasily at each other, and remembers how Ben finally stepped forward, cheeks pale and eyes downcast, face trembling all over as he fought grimly to keep from blubbering. Poor kid probably thought he was going to get 5 to 10 in Shawshank for back-flooding the drains on Witcham Street, Rich thinks now, but he had owned up to it just the same. And by doing that, he had forced the rest of them to come forward and back him up. It was either that or consider themselves bad guys, cowards. All the things their TV heroes were not. And that had welded them together, for better or worse. Had apparently welded them together for the last 27 years. Sometimes events are dominoes. The first knocks over the second knocks over the third, and there you are. When, Richie wonders, did it become too late to turn back? When he and Stan showed up and pitched in, helping to build the dam? When Bill told them how the school picture of his brother had turned its head and winked? Maybe. But to Rich Tozier, it seemed that the dominoes really began to fall when Ben Hanscom stepped forward and said, "I showed them, too. How to do it. It's my fault." Mr. Nell simply stood there looking at him, lips pressed together, hands on his creaking black leather belt. He looked from Ben to the spreading pool behind the dam and then back to Ben again, his face that of a man who can't believe what he is seeing. He was a burly Irishman, his hair a premature white, combed back in neat waves beneath his peaked blue cap. His eyes were bright blue, his nose bright red. There were small nests of burst capillaries in his cheeks. He was a man of no more than medium height, but to the five boys arrayed before him he looked at least 8 feet tall. Mr. Nell opened his mouth to speak, but before he could, Bill Dendro had stepped up beside Ben.
It was my idea,
he finally managed to say. He heaved in a gigantic, gulping breath, and as Mr. Nell stood there regarding him impassively, the sun tossing back imperial flashes from his badge, Bill managed to stutter out the rest of what he needed to say. It wasn't Ben's fault. Ben just happened to come along and show them how to do better what they were already doing badly.
Me too,
Eddie said abruptly, and stepped up on Ben's other side.
What's this me too?
Mr. Nell asked. Is that your name or your address, Buckaroo? Eddie flushed brightly. The color went all the way up to the roots of his hair.
I was with Bill before Ben even came, he said. That was all I meant.
Richie stepped up next to Eddie. The idea that a voice or two might cheer Mr. Nell up a little, get him thinking jolly thoughts, popped into his head. On second thought, and second thoughts were, for Richie, extremely rare and wonderful things, maybe a voice or two might only make things worse. Mr. Nell didn't look like he was in what Richie sometimes thought of as a chuckalicious mood. In fact, Mr. Nell looked like maybe chucks were the last thing in his mind. So he just said,
I was in on it too,
in a low voice, and then made his mouth shut up.
And me,
Stan said, stepping next to Bill. Now the five of them were standing before Mr. Nell in a line. Ben looked from one side to the other, more than dazed. He was almost stupefied by their support. For a moment, Richie thought old Haystack was going to burst into tears of gratitude.
Jesus,
Mr. Nell said again, and although he sounded deeply disgusted, his face suddenly looked as if it might like to laugh.
A sorrier bunch of boyos I ain't never seen. If your folks knew where you were, I guess there'd be some hot bottoms tonight. I ain't sure there won't be anyway.
Richie could hold back no longer. His mouth simply fell open and then ran away like the gingerbread man, as it so often did.
How's things back in the old country, Mr. Nell?
It bugled.
Ah, you're a sight for sore eyes. Sure and begorra, you're a lovely man, a credit to the old sod.
I'll be a credit to the seat of your pants in about 3 seconds, my dear little friend, Mr. Nell said dryly.
Bill turned on him, snarled, For God's sake, River Ritchie, shut up.
Good advice, Master William Denbrough, Mr. Nell said. I'll bet Zack doesn't know you're down here in the barns playing amongst the floating turdies, does he?
Bill dropped his eyes, shook his head. Wild roses burned in his cheeks. Mr. Nell looked at Ben.
I don't recall your name, son.
Ben Hanscom, sir,
Ben whispered. Mr. Nell nodded and looked back at the dam again.
This was your idea?
How to build it, yeah.
Ben's whisper was now nearly inaudible.
Well, you're a hell of an engineer, big boy, but you don't know jack shit about these here barns or the dairy drainage system, do you?
Ben shook his head. Not unkindly, Mr. Nell told him,
There's two parts to the system. One part carries solid human waste. Shit, if I'd not be offending your tender ears. The other part carries gray water, water flushed from toilets or run down the drains from sinks and washing machines and showers. It's also the water that runs down the gutters into the city drains. Well, you've caused no problems with the solid waste removal, thank God. All that gets pumped into the Kanduskeag a bit farther down. There's probably some almighty big patties down that way, half a mile drying in the sun thanks to what you done. But you can be pretty sure that there ain't shit sticking to anyone's ceiling because of it. But as for the gray water... Well, there's no pumps for gray water. That all runs downhill in what the engineer boyos call gravity drains. And I'll bet you know where all them gravity drains end up, don't you, big boy?
Up there, Ben said.
He pointed to the area behind the dam, the area they had in large part submerged. He did this without looking up. Big tears were beginning to course slowly down his cheeks. Mr. Nell pretended not to notice.
That's right, my large young friend. All them gravity drains feed into streams that feed into the upper barrens. In fact, a good many of them little streams that come trickling down are gray water and gray water only, coming out of drains you can't even see. They're so deep buried in the underbrush. The shit goes one way and everything else goes the other. God praise the clever mind of man. And did it ever cross your minds that you'd spent the whole livelong day paddling around in dairies, pee and old wash water?
Eddie suddenly began to gasp and had to use his aspirator.
What you did was back water up into about 6 of the 8 central catch basins that serve Wycheham and Jackson and Kansas, and 4 or 5 little streets that run between them.
Mr. Nell fixed Bill Denbrough with a dry glance.
One of them serves your own hearth and home, young Master Denbrough. So there we are, with sinks that won't drain, washing machines that won't drain, outflow pipes pouring merrily into cellars.
Ben let out a dry, barking sob. The others turned toward him and then looked away. Mr. Nell put a large hand on the boy's shoulder. It was calloused and hard, but at the moment it was also gentle.
Now, no need to take on, big boy. Maybe it ain't that bad, at least not yet. Could be I exaggerated just a mite to make sure you took my point. They sent me down to see if a tree blew down across the stream. That happens from time to time. There's no need for anyone but me and you five to know it wasn't just that. We've got more important things to worry about in town these days than a little backed-up water. I'll say in my report that I located the blowdown, and some boys came along and helped me shift it out of the way of the water. Not that I'll mention ye by name. You'll not be getting any citations for dam-building in the barns.
He surveyed the 5 of them. Ben was furiously wiping his eyes with his handkerchief. Bill was looking thoughtfully at the dam. Eddie was holding his aspirator in one hand. Stan stood close by Ritchie with one hand on Ritchie's arm, ready to squeeze, hard, if Ritchie should show the slightest sign of having anything to say other than thank you very much.
You boys got no business at all in a dirty place like this, Mr. Nell went on. There's probably 60 different kinds of disease breeding down here.
Breeding came out Braden, as in what a girl may do with her hair in the morning.
Dumped down one way, streams full of piss and gray water, muck and slop, bugs and brambles, quick mud. You got no business at all in a dirty place like this. 4 clean city parks for you boyos to be playing ball in all day long, and I catch you down here. Jesus Christ.
Well, but we like it down here,
Bill said suddenly and defiantly.
Well, when... Will we come down here? Nobody gives us any headache.
What'd he say?
Mr. Nell asked Eddie.
He said when we come down here, nobody gives us any static, Eddie said. His voice was thin and whistling, but it was also unmistakably firm. And he's right. When guys like us go to the park and say we want to play baseball, the other guys say, sure, you want to be second base or third.
Richie cackled. Eddie gets off a good one, and you are there.
Mr. Nell swung his head to look at him. Richie shrugged.
Sorry, but he's right, and Bill's right, too. We like it down here.
Richie thought Mr. Nell would become angry again at that, but the white-haired cop surprised him, surprised them all, with a smile.
Yep, he said. I liked it down here myself as a boy. So I did. And I'll not forbid ye. But hark to what I'm telling you now.
He leveled a finger at them, and they all looked at him soberly.
If ye come down here to play, ye come in a gang like ye are now, together. Do ye understand me?
They nodded.
That means together all the time. No hide-and-seek games where you're split up one and one and one. You all know what's going on in this town. All the same, I don't forbid you to come down here, mostly because you'd be down here anyway. But for your own good, here or anywhere around, gang together.
He looked at Bill.
Do you disagree with me, young Master Bill Denbro?
No, sir, Bill said. We'll stay
That's good enough for me, Mr. Nell said. Your hand on it.
Bill stuck out his hand, and Mr. Nell shook it. Richie shook off Stan and stepped forward.
Sure and begorra, Mr. Nell, you're a prince among men, ye are. A foine man, a foine man.
He stuck out his own hand, seized the Irishman's huge paw, and flagged it furiously, grinning all the time. To the bemused Mr. Nell, the boy looked like a hideous parody of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Thank you, boy, Mr. Nell said, retrieving his hand. You want to work on that a bit. As of now, ye sound about as Irish as Groucho Marx.
The other boys laughed, mostly in relief. Even as he was laughing, Stan shot Richie a reproachful look.
Grow up, Richie.
Mr. Nell shook hands all around, gripping Ben's last of all.
You've nothing to be ashamed of but bad judgment, big boy. As for that there, did you see how to do it in a book?
Ben shook his head.
Just figured it out?
Yes, sir.
Well, if that don't beat Harry, you'll do great things someday, I've no doubt. But the Barrens isn't the place to do 'em.
He looked around thoughtfully.
No great thing will ever be done here. Nasty place.
He sighed.
Tear it down, dear boys. Tear it right down. I believe I'll just sit me down in the shade of this bush here and bide a wee as you do it.
He looked ironically at Richie as he said this last, as if inviting another manic outburst.
Yes, sir,
Richie said humbly, and that was all. Mr. Nell nodded, satisfied, and the boys fell to work, once again turning to Ben, this time to show them the quickest way to tear down what he had shown them how to build. Meanwhile, Mr. Nell removed a brown bottle from inside his tunic and helped himself to a large gulp. He coughed, then blew out breath in an explosive sigh and regarded the boys with watery, benign eyes.
And what might ye have in your bottle, sir?
Richie asked from the place where he was standing knee-deep in the water.
Richie, can't you ever shut up?
Eddie hissed.
This?
Mr. Nell regarded Richie with mild surprise and looked at the bottle again. It had no label of any kind on it.
This is the cough medicine of the gods, my boy. Now let's see if you can bend your back anywhere near as fast as you can wag your tongue.
3. Bill and Richie were walking up Witcham Street together later on. Bill was pushing Silver. After first building and then tearing down the dam, he simply did not have the energy it would have taken to get Silver up to cruising speed. Both boys were dirty, disheveled, and pretty well used up. Stan had asked them if they wanted to come over to his house and play Monopoly or Parcheesi or something, but none of them wanted to. It was getting late. Ben, sounding tired and depressed, said he wanted to go home and see if anybody had returned his library books. He had some hope of this, since the Derry Library insisted on writing in the borrower's street address as well as his name on each book's pocket card. Eddie said he was going to watch The Rock Show on TV because Neil Sedaka was going to be on and he wanted to see if Neil Sedaka was a Negro. Stan told Eddie not to be so stupid. Neil Sedaka was white. You could tell he was white just listening to him. Eddie claimed you couldn't tell anything by listening to them. Until last year, he had been positive Chuck Berry was white. But when he was on Bandstand, he turned out to be a Negro.
My mother still thinks he's white, so that's one good thing, Eddie said. If she finds out he's a Negro, she probably won't let me listen to his songs anymore.
Stan bet Eddie 4 funny books that Neil Sedaka was white, and the two of them set off together for Eddie's house to settle the issue. And here were Bill and Richie, headed in a direction which would bring them to Bill's house after a while, neither of them talking much. Richie found himself thinking about Bill's story of the picture that had turned its head and winked. And in spite of his tiredness, an idea came to him. It was crazy, but it also held a certain attraction.
"Billy, me boy," he said, "let's stop for a while. Take 5. I'm dead."
"No such little luck," Bill said, but he stopped, laid Silver carefully down on the edge of the green theological seminary lawn, and the two boys sat on the wide stone steps which led up to the rambling red Victorian structure.
"What a day," Bill said glumly.
There were dark purplish patches under his eyes. His face looked white and used.
"You better call your house when will we get to mine, so your folks don't go bananas."
"Yeah, you bet. Listen, Bill." Richie paused for a moment, thinking about Ben's mummy, Eddie's leper, and whatever Stan had almost told them. For a moment, something swam in his own mind, something about that Paul Bunyan statue out by City Center. But that had only been a dream, for God's sake. He pushed away such irrelevant thoughts and plunged.
"Let's go up to your house. What do you say? Take a look in Georgie's room. I want to see that picture."
Bill looked at Richie, shocked. He tried to speak, but could not. His stress was simply too great. He settled for shaking his head violently. Richie said,
"You heard Eddie's story, and Ben's. Do you believe what they said?"
"I don't know. I think they must have seen something."
"Yeah, me too. All the kids that have been killed around here, I think all of them would have had stories to tell, too. The only difference between Ben and Eddie and those kids is that Ben and Eddie didn't get caught."
Bill raised his eyebrows, but showed no great surprise. Richie had supposed Bill would have taken it that far himself. He couldn't talk so good, but he was no dummy.
"So now dig on this a while, Big Bill," Richie said. "A guy could dress up in a clown suit and kill kids. I don't know why he'd want to, but nobody can tell why crazy people do things, right?"
Right.
It's not that much different than the Joker in a Batman funny book."
Just hearing his ideas out loud excited Richie. He wondered briefly if he was actually trying to prove something, or just throwing up a smokescreen of words so he could see that room, that picture. In the end, it probably didn't matter. In the end, maybe just seeing Bill's eyes light up with their own excitement was enough.
But where does the picture fit in?
"What do you think, Billy?" In a low voice, not looking at Richie, Bill said he didn't think it had anything to do with the murders.
"I think it was Georgie's ghost."
"A ghost in a picture?" Bill nodded. Richie thought about it. The idea of ghost gave his child's mind no trouble at all. He was sure there were such things. His parents were Methodists, and Richie went to church every Sunday and to Thursday night Methodist youth fellowship meetings as well. He knew a great deal of the Bible already, and he knew the Bible believed in all sorts of weird stuff. According to the Bible, God himself was at least one-third ghost, and that was just the beginning. You could tell the Bible believed in demons because Jesus threw a bunch of them out of the sky. Real chuckalicious ones, too. When Jesus asked the guy who had them what his name was, the demons answered and told him to go join the Foreign Legion, or something like that. The Bible believed in witches, or else why would it say, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live"? Some of the stuff in the Bible was even better than the stuff in the horror comics. People getting boiled in oil or hanging themselves like Judas Iscariot. The story about how wicked King Ahaz fell off the tower and all the dogs came and licked up his blood. The mass baby murders that had accompanied the births of both Moses and Jesus Christ. Guys who came out of their graves or flew into the air. Soldiers who witched down walls. Prophets who saw the future and fought monsters. All of that was in the Bible, and every word of it was true. So said Reverend Craig, and so said Richie's folks, and so said Richie. He was perfectly willing to credit the possibility of Bill's explanation. It was the logic which troubled him.
"But you said you were scared. Why would George's ghost want to scare you, Bill?"
Bill put a hand to his mouth and wiped it. The hand was trembling slightly.
"He's probably mad at me for getting him killed. It was my fault. I sent him out with the
He was incapable of getting the word out, so he rocked his hand in the air instead. Richie nodded to show he understood what Bill meant, but not to indicate agreement.
I don't think so, he said. If you stabbed him in the back or shot him, that would be different. Or even if you, like, gave him a loaded gun that belonged to your dad to play with and he shot himself with it. But it wasn't a gun. It was just a boat. You didn't want to hurt him. In fact, Richie raised one finger and waggled it at Bill in a lawyerly way. You just wanted the kid to have a little fun, right?
Bill thought back, thought desperately hard. What Richie had just said had made him feel better about George's death for the first time in months. But there was a part of him which insisted, with quiet firmness, that he was not supposed to feel better. Of course it was your fault, that part of him insisted. Not entirely, maybe, but at least partly. If not, how come there's that cold place on the couch between your mother and father? If not, how come no one ever says anything at the supper table anymore? Now it's just knives and forks rattling until you can't take it anymore and ask if you can be excused, please. It was as if he were the ghost, a presence that spoke and moved but was not quite heard or seen, a thing vaguely sensed but still not accepted as real. He did not like the thought that he was to blame, but the only alternative he could think of to explain the behavior was much worse, that all the love and attention his parents had given him before had somehow been the result of George's presence, and with George gone there was nothing for him. And all of that had happened at random, for no reason at all. And if you put your ear to that door, you could hear the winds of madness blowing outside. So he went over what he had done and felt and said on the day Georgie had died, part of him hoping that what Richie had said was true, part of him hoping just as hard it was not. He hadn't been a saint of a big brother to George, that much was certain. They had fights, plenty of them. Surely there had been one that day. No, no fight. For one thing, Bill himself had still been feeling too punk to work up a really good quarrel with George. He had been sleeping, dreaming something, dreaming about some turtle. Funny little animal, he couldn't remember just what, and he had awakened to the sound of the diminishing rain outside and George muttering unhappily to himself in the dining room. He asked George what was wrong. George came in and said he was trying to make a paper boat from the directions of his best book of activities, but it kept coming out wrong. Bill told George to bring his book, and sitting next to Richie on the steps leading up to the seminary, he remembered how Georgie's eyes lit up when the paper boat came out right, and how good that look had made him feel, like Georgie thought he was a real hot shit, a straight shooter, the guy who could do it until it got done. Making him feel, in short, like a big brother. The boat had killed George, but Richie was right. It hadn't been like handing George a loaded gun to play with. Bill hadn't known what was going to happen. No way he could. He drew a deep, shuddering breath, feeling something like a rock, something he hadn't even known was there, go rolling off his chest. All at once he felt better, better about everything. He opened his mouth to tell Richie this and burst into tears instead. Alarmed, Richie put an arm around Bill's shoulders. After taking a quick glance around to make sure no one who might mistake them for a couple of fagolas was looking. You're okay, he said. You're okay, Billy, right? Come on, turn off the waterworks.
I didn't want him to get killed,
Bill sobbed.
That wasn't on my mind at all.
Christ, Billy, I know it wasn't, Richie said. If you'd wanted to scrub him, you would have pushed him downstairs or something. Richie patted Bill's shoulder clumsily and gave him a hard little hug before letting go. Come on, quit bawling, okay? You sound like a baby. Little by little, Bill stopped. He still hurt, but this hurt seemed cleaner, as if he had cut himself open and taken out something that was rotting inside him. And that feeling of relief was still there.
I didn't want him to get killed, Bill repeated. And if you to tell anybody I was crying, I'll bust your nose.
I won't tell, Richie said. Don't worry. He was your brother, for gosh sake. If my brother got killed, I'd cry my fucking head off.
You don't have a brother.
Yeah, but if I did.
You would?
Of course. Richie paused, fixing Bill with a wary eye, trying to decide if Bill was really over it. He was still wiping his red eyes with his snot rag, but Richie decided he probably was.
All I meant was that I don't know why George would want to haunt you. So maybe the picture's got something to do with... well, with that other. The clown.
Maybe George doesn't know. Maybe he thinks.
Richie understood what Bill was trying to say and waved it aside. After you croak, you know everything people ever thought about you, Big Bill. He spoke with the indulgent air of a great teacher correcting a country bumpkin's fatuous ideas.
It's in the Bible. It says, "Yea, even though we can't see too much in the mirror right now, we will see through it like it was a window after we die." That's in 1 Thessalonians or 2 Babylonians, I forget which. It means,
I see what it means, Bill said.
So what do you say?
Huh?
Let's go up to his room and take a look. Maybe we'll get a clue about who's killing all the kids.
I'm scared to.
I am too, Richie said, thinking it was just more sand, something to say that would get Bill moving. And then something heavy turned over in his midsection, and he discovered it was true. He was scared green.
4. The two boys slipped into the Denbrough house like ghosts. Bill's father was still at work. Sharon Denbrough was in the kitchen reading a paperback at the kitchen table. The smell of supper, codfish, drifted out into the front hall. Richie called home so his mom would know he wasn't dead, just at Bill's.
Someone there? Mrs. Denbrough called as Richie put the phone down.
They froze, eyeing each other guiltily. Then Bill called,
"Mamie, Mom, and
Richie Tozier, ma'am," Richie yelled.
"Hello, Richie,"
Mrs. Denbrough called back, her voice disconnected, almost not there at all.
"Would you like to stay for supper?"
"Thanks, ma'am, but my mom's going to pick me up in half an hour or so."
"Tell her I said hello, won't you?"
"Yes, ma'am, I sure will."
Come on, Bill whispered. "That's enough for small talk."
They went upstairs and down the hall to Bill's room. It was boy neat, which meant it would have given the mother of the boy in question only a mild headache to look at. The shelves were stuffed with a helter-skelter collection of books and comics. There were more comics, plus a few models and toys, and a stack of 45s on the desk. There was also an old Underwood office model typewriter on it. His folks had given it to him for Christmas 2 years ago, and Bill sometimes wrote stories on it. He did this a bit more frequently since George's death. The pretending seemed to ease his mind. There was a phonograph on the floor across from the bed with a pile of folded clothes stacked on the lid. Bill put the clothes in the drawers of his bureau and then took the records from the desk. He shuffled through them, picking half a dozen. He put them on the phonograph's fat spindle and turned the machine on. The Fleetwood started singing, "Come Softly, Darling." Richie held his nose. Bill grinned in spite of his thumping heart.
"They don't hike rock and roll," he said. "They gave me this one for my birthday. Also two Papat Baboon records and Tommy Sands. I keep little Richard and Screamin' J.J. Hawkins for when they're not here. But if she hears the music, she'll think we're in my room. Come on."
George's room was across the hall. The door was shut. Richie looked at it and licked his lips.
"They don't keep it locked?" he whispered to Bill.
Suddenly he found himself hoping it was locked. Suddenly, he was having trouble believing this had been his idea. Bill, his face pale, shook his head and turned the knob. He stepped in and looked back at Richie. After a moment, Richie followed. Bill shut the door behind them, muffling the Fleetwoods. Richie jumped a little at the soft snick of the latch. He looked around, fearful and intensely curious at the same time. The first thing he noticed was the dry mustiness of the air.
"No one's opened a window in here for a long time," he thought. "Heck, no one's breathed in here for a long time. That's really what it feels like."
He shuddered a little at the thought and licked his lips again. His eye fell on George's bed, and the thought of George sleeping now under a comforter of earth in Mount Hope Cemetery. Rotting there, his hands not folded because you needed two hands to do that old folding routine, and George had been buried with only one. A little sound escaped Richie's throat. Bill turned and looked at him inquiringly.
"You're right," Richie said huskily. "It's spooky in here. I don't see how you could stand to come in alone."
"He was my brother," Bill said simply. "Sometimes I want to, is all."
There were posters on the walls, little kid posters. One showed Tom Terrific, the cartoon character on Captain Kangaroo's program. Tom was springing over the head and clutching hands of Krabby Appleton, who was, of course, rotten to the core. Another showed Donald Duck's nephews, Huey, Louie, and Dewey, marching off into the wilderness in their junior woodchuck's coonskin caps. A third, which George had colored himself, showed Mr. Dew holding up traffic so a bunch of little kids headed for school could cross the street. Mr. Dew says, "Wait for the crossing guard," it said underneath.
Kid wasn't too cool about staying in the lines, Richie thought, and then shuddered. The kid was never going to get any better at it either.
Richie looked at the table by the window. Mrs. Denbro had stood up all of George's rank cards there, half open. Looking at them, knowing there would never be more, knowing that George had died before he could stay in the lines when he colored, knowing his life had ended irrevocably and eternally with only those few kindergarten and first grade rank cards, all the idiot truth of death crashed home to Richie for the first time. It was as if a large iron safe had fallen into his brain and buried itself there.
"I could die,"
his mind screamed at him suddenly in tones of betrayed horror.
"Anybody could. Anybody could."
"Boy, oh boy," he said in a shaky voice. He could manage no more.
"Yeah,"
Bill said in a near whisper. He sat down in George's bed.
"Look."
Richie followed Bill's pointing finger and saw the photo album lying closed on the floor. "My photographs," Richie read. "George Elmer Denbro, age 6.
Age 6?
His mind shrieked in those same tones of shrill betrayal.
Age 6 forever. Anybody could. Shit. Fucking anybody.
"It was open, Bill said. "But before."
"So it closed," Richie said uneasily.
He sat down on the bed beside Bill and looked at the photo album. "Lots of books close on their own."
"The pages, maybe. But not the cover.
It closed itself." He looked at Richie solemnly, his eyes very dark in his pale, tired face.
"But it wants you to open it up again. That's what I think."
Richie got up and walked slowly over to the photograph album. It lay at the base of a window screened with light curtains. Looking out, he could see the apple tree in the Denbro backyard. A swing rocked slowly back and forth from one gnarled black limb. He looked down at George's book again. A dried maroon stain colored the thickness of the pages in the middle of the book. It could have been old ketchup. Sure, it was easy enough to see George looking at his photo album while eating a hot dog or a big sloppy hamburger. He takes a big bite and some ketchup squirts out onto the book. Little kids were always doing spasmoid stuff like that. It could be ketchup. But Richie knew it was not. He touched the album briefly and then drew his hand away. It felt cold. It had been lying in a place where the strong summer sunlight, only slightly filtered by those light curtains, would have been falling on it all day. But it felt cold.
"Well, I'll just leave it alone," Richie thought. "I don't want to look in his stupid old album anyway, see a lot of people I don't know. I think maybe I'll tell Bill I changed my mind, and we can go to his room and read comic books for a while, and then I'll go home and eat supper and go to bed early because I'm pretty tired. And when I wake up tomorrow morning, I'm sure I'll be sure that stuff was just ketchup. That's what I'll do. Yowza."
So he opened the album with hands that seemed 1,000 miles away from him, at the end of long plastic arms, and he looked at the faces and places in George's album, the aunts, the uncles, the babies, the houses, the old Fords and Studebakers, the telephone lines, the mailboxes, the picket fences, the wheel ruts with muddy water in them, the Ferris wheel at the Estee County Fair, the standpipe, the ruins of the Kitchener Ironworks. His fingers flipped faster and faster, and suddenly the pages were blank. He turned back, not wanting to, but unable to help himself. Here was a picture of downtown Derry, Main Street and Canal Street from around 1930, and beyond it there was nothing.
"There's no school picture of George in here," Richie said.
He looked at Bill with a mixture of relief and exasperation.
"What kind of line were you handing me, Big Bill?"
What?
"This picture of downtown in the olden days is the last one in the book. All the rest of the pages are blank." Bill got off the bed and joined Richie. He looked at the picture of downtown Derry as it had been almost 30 years ago. Old-fashioned cars and trucks, old-fashioned street lights with clusters of globes like big white grapes, pedestrians by the canal caught in mid-stride by the click of a shutter.
He turned the page, and just as Richie had said, there was nothing. No, wait, not quite nothing. There was one studio corner, the sort of item you use to mount photographs.
It was here,
he said, and tapped the studio corner.
Look.
Jeepers, what do you think happened to it?
I don't know.
Bill had taken the album from Richie and was now holding it on his own lap. He turned back through the pages, looking for George's picture. He gave up after a minute, but the pages did not. They turned themselves, flipping slowly but steadily with big, deliberate riffling sounds. Bill and Richie looked at each other wide-eyed and then back down. It arrived at that last picture again, and the pages stopped turning. Here was downtown Derry in sepia tones, the city as it had been long before either Bill or Richie had been born.
Say,
Richie said suddenly and took the album back from Bill. There was no fear in his voice now, and his face was suddenly full of wonder.
Holy shit!
Well, what? What is it?
Us!
That's what it is. Holy Geesley Crow, look! Bill took one side of the book, bent over it, sharing it. They looked like boys at choir practice. Bill drew in breath sharply, and Richie knew he had seen it, too. Caught under the shiny surface of this old black-and-white photograph, two small boys were walking along Main Street toward the point where Main and Center intersected, the point where the canal went underground for a mile and a half or so. The two boys showed up clearly against the low concrete wall at the edge of the canal. One was wearing knickers. The other was wearing something that looked almost like a sailor suit. A tweed cap was perched on his head. They were turned in three-quarter profile toward the camera, looking at something on the far side of the street. The boy in the knickers was Richie Tozier, beyond a doubt, and the boy in the sailor suit and the tweed cap was Stuttering Bill. They stared at themselves in a picture, almost three times as old as they were, hypnotized. The inside of Richie's mouth suddenly felt as dry as dust and as smooth as glass. A few steps ahead of the boys in the picture, there was a man holding the brim of his fedora, his top coat frozen forever as it flapped out behind him in a sudden gust of wind. There were Model Ts on the street, a Pierce Arrow, Chevrolets with running boards.
I don't believe,
Bill began, and that was when the picture began to move. The Model T that should have remained eternally in the middle of the intersection, or at least until the chemicals in the old photo finally dissolved completely, passed through it, a haze of exhaust puffing out of its tailpipe. It went on toward Up Mile Hill. A small white hand shot out of the driver's side window and signaled a left turn. It swung onto Court Street and passed beyond the photo's white border and so out of sight. The Pierce Arrow, the Chevrolets, the Packards, they all began to roll along, dodging their separate ways through the intersection. After 28 years or so, the skirt of the man's topcoat finally finished its flap. He settled his hat more firmly on his head and walked on. The two boys completed their turn, coming full face, and a moment later Richie saw what they had been looking at as a mangy dog came trotting across Center Street. The boy in the sailor suit, Bill, raised two fingers to the corners of his mouth and whistled. Stunned beyond any ability to move or think, Richie realized he could hear the whistle, could hear the car's irregular sewing machine engines. The sounds were faint, like sounds heard through thick glass, but they were there. The dog glanced toward the two boys, then trotted on. The boys glanced at each other and laughed like chipmunks. They started to walk on, and then the Richie in knickers grabbed Bill's arm and pointed toward the canal. They turned in that direction.
No,
Richie thought. Don't do that, don't. They went to the low concrete wall, and suddenly the clown popped up over its edge like a horrible jack-in-the-box. A clown with Georgie Denbrough's face, his hair slicked back, his mouth a hideous grin full of bleeding grease paint, his eyes black holes. One hand clutched three balloons on a string. With the other, he reached for the boy in the sailor suit and seized his neck.
No,
Bill cried and reached for the picture. Reached into the picture.
Stop it, Bill,
Richie shouted and grabbed for him. He was almost too late. He saw the tips of Bill's fingers go through the surface of the photograph and into that other world. He saw the fingertips go from the warm pink of living flesh to the mummified cream color that passed for white in old photos. At the same time, they became small and disconnected. It was like the peculiar optical illusion one sees when one thrusts a hand into a glass bowl of water. The part of the hand underwater seems to be floating, disembodied, inches away from the part which is still out of the water. A series of diagonal cuts slashed across Bill's fingers at the point where they ceased being his fingers and became photo fingers. It was as if he had stuck his hand into the blades of a fan instead of into a picture. Richie seized his forearm and gave a tremendous yank. They both fell over. George's album hit the floor and snapped itself shut with a dry clap. Bill stuck his fingers in his mouth. Tears of pain stood in his eyes. Richie could see blood running down his palm to his wrist in thin streams.
"Let me see," he said. "It hurts," Bill said.
He held his hand out to Richie, palm down. There were ladder-like slash cuts running up his index, second, and third fingers. The pinky had barely touched the surface of the photograph, if it had a surface. And although that finger had not been cut, Bill told Richie later that the nail had been neatly clipped, as if with a pair of manicurist scissors.
"Jesus, Bill," Richie said.
Band-aids. That was all he could think of. God, they had been lucky. If he hadn't pulled Bill's arm when he did, his fingers might have been amputated instead of just badly cut.
"We got to fix those up. Your mother can..." "Never mind my mother," Bill said.
He grabbed the photo album again, spilling drops of blood on the floor.
"Don't open that again," Richie cried, grabbing frantically at Bill's shoulder. "Jesus Christ, Billy, you almost lost your fingers."
Bill shook him off. He flipped through the pages, and there was a grim determination on his face that scared Richie more than anything else. Bill's eyes looked almost mad. His wounded fingers printed George's album with new blood. It didn't look like ketchup yet, but when it had a little time to dry, it would. Of course it would. And here was the downtown scene again. The Model T stood in the middle of the intersection. The other cars were frozen in the places where they had been before. The man walking toward the intersection held the brim of his fedora, his coat once more belled out in mid-flap. The two boys were gone. There were no boys in the picture anywhere, but...
"Look,"
Richie whispered and pointed. He was careful to keep the tip of his finger well away from the picture. An arc showed just over the low concrete wall at the edge of the canal, the top of something round. Something like a balloon. 5. They got out of George's room just in time. Bill's mother was a voice at the foot of the stairs and a shadow on the wall.
"Have you boys been wrestling?" she asked sharply. "I heard a thud."
"Just a little, Mom."
Bill threw a sharp glance at Richie. "Be quiet," it said.
"Well, I want you to stop it. I thought the ceiling was going to come right down on my head."
We will."
They heard her go back toward the front of the house. Bill had wrapped his handkerchief around his bleeding hand. It was turning red and in a moment would start to drip. The boys went down to the bathroom, where Bill held his hand under the faucet until the bleeding stopped. Cleaned, the cuts looked thin but cruelly deep. Looking at their white lips and the red meat just inside them made Richie feel sick to his stomach. He wrapped them with band-aids as fast as he could.
"It hurts like hell," Bill said.
"Well, why'd you want to go and put your hand in there, you wet end?"
Bill looked solemnly at the rings of band-aids on his fingers, then up at Richie.
It was the clown, he said. It was the clown pretending to be Judge George.
That's right, Richie said. Like it was the clown pretending to be the mummy when Ben saw it. Like it was the clown pretending to be that sick bum Eddie saw.
The leper.
Right.
But is it really a clown?
It's a monster, Richie said flatly.
Some kind of monster.
Some kind of monster right here in Derry. And it's killing kids.
6. On a Saturday, not long after the incident of the dam and the barrens, Mr. Nell and the picture that moved, Richie, Ben, and Beverly Marsh, came face to face with not one monster but two. And they paid to do it. Richie did anyway. These monsters were scary, but not really dangerous. They stalked their victims on the screen of the Aladdin Theater while Richie, Ben, and Bev watched from the balcony. One of the monsters was a werewolf, played by Michael Landon, and he was cool because even when he was the werewolf, he still had sort of a duck's ass haircut. The other was this smashed-up hot rodder, played by Gary Conway. He was brought back to life by a descendant of Victor Frankenstein, who fed all parts he didn't need to a bunch of alligators he kept in the basement. Also on the program, a movie-tone newsreel that showed the latest Paris fashions and the latest Vanguard rocket explosions at Cape Canaveral, two Warner Brothers cartoons, one Popeye cartoon, and a Chilly Willy cartoon. For some reason, the hat Chilly Willy wore always cracked Richie up. And previews of coming attractions. The coming attractions included two pictures Richie immediately put on his Gotta See list. I Married a Monster from Outer Space and The Blob. Ben was very quiet during the show. Old Haystack had nearly been spotted by Henry, Belch, and Victor earlier, and Richie assumed that was all that was troubling him. Ben, however, had forgotten all about the creeps. They were sitting close to the screen down below, chucking popcorn boxes at each other and hooting. Beverly was the reason for his silence. Her nearness was so overwhelming that he was almost ill with it. His body would break out in goosebumps, and then, if she would so much as shift in her seat, his skin would flash hot, as if with a tropical fever. When her hand brushed his, reaching for the popcorn, he trembled with exultation. He thought later that those 3 hours in the dark next to Beverly had been both the longest and shortest hours of his life. Richie, unaware that Ben was in deep throes of calf love, was feeling just as fine as paint. In his book, the only thing any better than a couple of Francis the Talking Mule pictures was a couple of horror pictures in a theater filled with kids, all of them yelling and screaming at the gory parts. He certainly did not connect any of the goings-ons in the two low-budget American International Pictures they were watching with what was going on in town. Not then, at least. He had seen the Twin Shock Show Saturday matinee ad in the news on Friday morning, and had almost immediately forgotten how badly he had slept the night before, and how he had finally gotten up and turned on the light in his closet, a real baby trick for sure, but he hadn't been able to get a wink of sleep until he'd done it. But by the following morning, things had seemed normal again. Well, almost. He began to think that maybe he and Bill had just shared a hallucination. Of course, the cuts on Bill's fingers weren't a hallucination, but maybe they'd just been paper cuts from some of the sheets in Georgie's album. Pretty thick paper. Could have been. Maybe. Besides, there was no law saying he had to spend the next 10 years thinking about it, was there? Nope. And so, following an experience that might well have sent an adult running for the nearest head shrinker, Richie Tozier got up, ate a giant pancake breakfast, saw the ad for the two horror movies on the amusements page of the paper, checked his funds, found them a little low, well, non-existent might actually have been a better word, and began to pester his father for chores. His dad, who had come to the table already wearing his white dentist tunic, put down the sports pages and poured himself a second cup of coffee. He was a pleasant-looking man with a rather thin face. He wore steel-rimmed spectacles, was developing a bald spot at the back of his head, and would die of cancer of the larynx in 1973. He looked at the ad to which Richie was pointing. "Horror movies," Wentworth Tozier said. "Yeah," Richie said, grinning. "Feel like you have to go," Wentworth Tozier said. "Yeah. Feel like you'll probably die in convulsions of disappointment if you don't get to see those two trashy movies." "Yeah, yeah, I would. I know I would." "Greg!" Richie fell out of his chair onto the floor, clutching his throat, his tongue sticking out. This was Richie's admittedly peculiar way of turning on the charm. "Oh, God, Richie, will you please stop it?" his mother asked him from the stove where she was frying him a couple of eggs to top off the pancakes. "Gee, Rich," his father said as Richie got back into his chair, "I guess I must have forgotten to pay you your allowance on Monday. That's the only reason I can think of for you needing more money on Friday." "Well, gone?" "Well, that's an extremely deep subject for a boy with such a shallow mind," Wentworth Tozier said. He put his elbow on the table and then cupped his chin on the palm of his hand, regarding his only son with what appeared to be deep fascination. "Where'd it go?" Richie immediately fell into the voice of Toodles the English butler.
"Why, I spent it, didn't I, Governor? Pip-pip, cheerio, and all that rot. My part of the war effort. All got to do our bit to beat back the bloody Hun, don't we? Bit of a sticky wicket, eh, what? Bit of a wet hedgehog, what? Bit of a
pile of bullshit," Wentz said amiably and reached for the strawberry preserves. Spare me the vulgarity at the breakfast table, if you please, Maggie Tozier said to her husband as she brought Richie's eggs over to the table. And to Richie, I don't know why you want to fill your head up with such awful junk anyway. Oh, Mom, Richie said. He was outwardly crushed, inwardly jubilant. He could read both of his parents like books. Well-worn and well-loved books, and he was pretty sure he was going to get what he wanted. Chores and permission to go to the show Saturday afternoon. Wendt leaned forward toward Richie and smiled widely.
I think I have you right where I want you, he said.
Is that right, Dad? Richie said and smiled back, a trifle uneasily.
Oh, yes. You know our lawn, Richie. You are familiar with our lawn?
Indeed I am, Governor, Richie said, becoming Toodles again, or trying to.
Bit shaggy, eh, what?
What? Wendt said. And you, Richie, will remedy that condition.
I will?
You will. Mow it, Richie.
Okay, Dad, sure,
Richie said, but a terrible suspicion had suddenly blossomed in his mind. Maybe his dad didn't mean just the front lawn. Wentworth Tozier's smile widened to a predatory shark's grin.
All of it, O idiot child of my loins. Front, back, sides. And when you finish, I will cross your palm with two green pieces of paper with the likeness of George Washington on one side and a picture of a pyramid o'ertopped with the ever-watching oculary on the other.
I don't get you, Dad, Richie said, but he was afraid he did.
$2.
$2 for the whole lawn? Richie cried, genuinely wounded. It's the biggest lawn on the block. Geez, Dad. Wendt sighed and picked the paper up again. Richie could read the front page headline, Missing Boy Prompts New Fears. He thought briefly of George Denbrough's strange scrapbook. But that had surely been a hallucination. And even if it hadn't been, that was yesterday and this was today.
Guess you didn't want to see those movies as bad as you thought, Wendt said from behind the paper.
A moment later, his eyes appeared over the top, studying Richie. Studying him a trifle smugly, in truth. Studying him the way a man with four of a kind studies his poker opponent over the fan of his cards.
When the Clark twins do it all, you give them $2 each.
That's true, Wendt admitted. But as far as I know, they don't want to go to the movies tomorrow. Or if they do, they must have funds sufficient to the occasion because they haven't popped by to check the state of our herbiage around our domicile lately. You, on the other hand, do want to go and find yourself lacking the funds to do so. That pressure you feel in your midsection may be the 5 pancakes and 2 eggs you ate for breakfast, Richie, or it may just be the barrel I have you over. What? Wendt's eyes submerged behind the paper again.
He's blackmailing me, Richie said to his mother, who was eating dry toast. She was trying to lose weight again. This is blackmail. I just hope you know that.
Yes, dear, I know that, his mother said.
There's egg on your chin.